I'm Jessica Wilson, and you're listening to Making It Awkward. Welcome back. Today, you'll hear my interview with Chrissy King, author of The Body Liberation Project, How Understanding Racism and Diet Culture Helps Cultivate Joy and Build Collective Freedom. You'll hear a great discussion about rejecting the romanticization of partnership, settling when it comes to finding a partner, especially for Black women, and what to expect when you're writing a book. Since last week's episode came out, I shared Allison's reenactment on Instagram and YouTube. I was surprised at how many folks thought it was a very fun and creative parody of the publishing industry. And I absolutely see how it was giving more SNL than top five publisher. I then posted the letter in its entirety to social media, and it became more real for people. It also became more real to me. I received that letter on July 6, 2022, and I'd only shared the story about Geneva and Cheerio with fewer than 15 people since. When I'd be asked about the publishing process, I'd just say it was hard and that my publisher had been less than supportive. I didn't want to burn bridges with the people who were supposed to be publicizing, selling, and marketing my book. It wasn't until talking about it with my therapist after the book was published that she was able to identify my feeling of shame about the letter. I hated to admit it, but she was right. I had set clear boundaries and expectations of the support I'd need if I agreed to write the book, which, again, I was asked to write. I was assured that at every step of the way, someone would get it. And I trusted that. As someone with very clear boundaries and is typically not a gullible person, I was feeling shame that I believed the team. I wrote a delightful book. It's funny, not laugh out loud for 10 days straight funny, but my wit and dry humor runs throughout the book, and folks get to join me for wild experiences like Gwyneth Paltrow's In Goop Summit. The book is as fun in parts as it is serious in others. It has the depth found in community and also critiques white women for not washing their legs. I know, hashtag not all white women. It has also taught a lot of people about how things like respectability and resilience have shaped our lives. I wrote a good book, and I had a lot of shame, and I know that's silly now, which is why posting Allison's reenactment and the letter on social media was surprisingly so healing for me. I didn't have to hold it anymore. The Instagram post has reached 48,000 accounts as of right now. It's not just me and my 15 friends. It feels great to laugh at everyone's comments. It's been healing. But I'm not quite done with Geneva and Cheerio yet. I'll get to that at the end of my interview with Chrissy. A quick note that this conversation contains a brief mention of purging in the context of disordered eating. And with that, let's get to the interview. Chrissy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jessica. I'm so happy to be here. It's so good to be able to talk with you and just like see your face again.
I know. The last time was when we did a book event together in Brooklyn. That was fantastic.
It seems like a lifetime ago. Well, I don't even remember what month that was. It feels like a long time.
It could have been a year ago. I just don't know. It was June.
I don't even know what is time.
Yeah, April. Anyway, yeah. Maybe. Yeah. After you've written a book, like the next year or so, just kind of evaporates in time.
Yes. It's just the haze.
All right. Tell the folks about your book origin story.
Yeah. So I am the author of The Body Liberation Project, How Understanding Racism and Diet Culture Helps Cultivate Joy and Build Collective Freedom. And I would say my book's origin story, I don't think that when I wrote the book, this is what I was thinking. But like in hindsight, I can just say like, this is the book that I needed to read when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. Right. And I don't think I realized that's what I was writing when I was writing it. But definitely looking back, that's exactly what I wrote. And it feels very much like just a breath of fresh air for my younger self. Yeah.
Totally. In the book, you start off with a lot of the personal stuff in younger self. Do you want to tell us a bit about that part?
Yeah, sure. So I currently live in Brooklyn, New York, but I grew up in the Midwest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was homeschooled for the first few years of my life. And then I went to private Christian school when I was in the third grade, and it was far out in the suburbs. I was the only Black girl in the class. There were only two other Black kids in the school, my brother and my sister. So I was the only one like me. And I was also 5'8 in the third grade. So I was taller than the teacher. I was obviously taller than all of my classmates. And I think prior to going to that school, like I knew that I was like tall or whatever, but being in that school where I was the only one who looked like me, most of my peers had never like interacted with Black kids. Mm-hmm. Like they were like, well, you know, we don't know anybody who's Black. Mm-hmm. And also being so tall and just feeling really different. Mm-hmm. I think that's the first place where I started to really feel like I was trying to figure out how I could just try to fit in. Right. And so there were so many, like, I wasn't going to be like short and blonde hair and blue eyed. So I was like, well, at least I can try to be skinny. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, that's the thing that I can try to do. And I can also try to be like the smartest person in my class. Mm-hmm. I can try to prove to people that like I am one of the good Black ones, so to speak. And so I think that really had a huge impact on my upbringing into like my 20s, yeah, for sure, where I was always trying to contort myself and to somehow, you know, assimilate into respectability politics and also just like whiteness, mm-hmm, in any ways that I could, even though I didn't really have the verbiage at the time to like know that that's what I was doing.
Sure. Looking back now, would you say that you had anorexia or an eating disorder?
I can for sure say I had disordered eating.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never really sat with it enough to say. I mean, there were times in my life where I struggled with like throwing up. I don't ever know that I did it long enough to say that I was bulimic, but I don't even know like what's the metric, right? Like how many times, yeah, do you have to do that, mm-hmm, to then say I am in fact bulimic, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe in hindsight, yes, maybe I had all the things, because it's like for me, I've never really thought like what's the line, yep, that you draw, right, to say yes, I have eating disorder, mm-hmm, because I did it this many times, or and then I stopped, yep, or you know, I starved myself. And I mean, in college, there were days when like I knew I was going to go out at night, and so I would not eat all day, or I would eat, yeah, I would like starve myself during the day, mm-hmm, and then I'd eat like a low-cal, low-carb grilled cheese sandwich, and then I would binge drink at night.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe it sounds like I had an eating disorder, actually. Yeah, probably so.
Isn't that an interesting one? I think about that for myself, and I'm like, okay, I probably would not say that I had an eating disorder because all, you know, I was surviving, I was doing all of the things, and exactly like you, like, oh, what are these fine lines? But if, right, we were like small, thin girls, white girls, like you and I might be able, you know, easily just because of how our society is structured to be like, oh, that was definitely an eating disorder. But I find it wild. Like when I think about it, just as you were saying, these like long sentences and like, I don't know, maybe, and this and that, it is exactly like a similar feeling for me. And it's wild, even as a clinician who, you know, I should be able to know, but I'm like, is it actually, I don't know.
And I think you bring up a really good point, though, because like even when I was growing up, when, you know, the face of eating disorders were always like thin white women. Mm-hmm. And so like I did not fit into that category. So like how could I possibly have an eating disorder? Right. Mm-hmm. Like that I didn't see myself represented in the eating disorder community whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So like clearly I didn't have an eating disorder.
Absolutely.
Right. Or at least that's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. It's odd. I've only been thinking about that lately, and I'm like, I still don't know. Like, what would I say? Which is the conversation in itself. Like, the fact that we're, yeah, like, maybe is, yeah.
Or maybe I do.
Yeah. It's the conversation, but okay. So you told us a bit about your body story, and I'm really appreciative of that. Can you tell us about the adult version of this body story, particularly the dating part, which I love hearing about always?
Yes. So I was married actually until I was like 33. So I was married from the age of like 22 to 33. Mm-hmm. And I started dating my husband when I was 19. So he was really on the journey with me all of my body stuff, right? And he is the kindest and most supportive man. And so I remember there were times when I was like really struggling with body image, really deep in diet culture, like really disordered eating. And, you know, he just was like supportive in the best ways that he could. And I think this is really interesting is that like, he also was with me when my body's like in all these different variations, mm-hmm, of it, right? When I was like larger, when I was really thin, mm-hmm, when I was in between. And the thing that always stuck out to me about him is like, when I would go through this body changes, he would always say like, yeah, I didn't really notice like, mm-hmm, your body. Like I didn't really notice the changes. Right. I'm like, well, that's great. I appreciate that. Right. But I think though, since I got divorced or separated when I was 33. And then obviously I'm dating for the first time, as an adult woman, and that is dating men. Mm-hmm. That is terrifying. Right. Mm-hmm. And it just feels so different than being with a person who's like seeing you through all of these different iterations of your body and has totally like fully embraced them all, then going out into the world and not recognizing, because I already knew it, but like really firsthand seeing how differently people treat you based on the size of your body, especially when you're heterosexual and dating men. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really interesting because oftentimes, you know, I think we get told that like, if you lose weight or if you do all these things, like your chances for finding someone are going to like increase. And I really think it's so terrible that we tell women that, because realistically, I don't want to be in a partnership with a person who is only interested in me if I'm in a thin body, because mm-hmm. bodies can and will change.
Right.
And so it's like, I'm not trying to attract somebody based on them being interested in the size of my body. And so perhaps to some people that feels like your options are limited, but let me tell you, I will rather have my options limited, even if that meant being single for the rest of my life,
okay,
than finding myself in a situation with a person who did not value me mm-hmm. because my body changed.
Yes.
And I know I know that sounds easier said than done for some people. Mm-hmm. And I acknowledge that. I also acknowledge that I was married to a really wonderful person for a long time. So I had a really positive experience with romance and relationship and marriage. Mm-hmm. And so for some people who maybe have never experienced that and feels like that's the thing they're waiting for, mm-hmm. it feels really hard to be like, I'm decentering men from the center of my, because I don't care. So I know I'm coming from, like, it feels much easier for me in this current place in my life to completely decenter men and be like, I don't care if I end up in a relationship or not. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not always as easy for other folks.
Yeah. So are you dating somebody right now?
No, I'm not dating anybody right now. I am happily single. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the things I'm also I'm writing another book, but one of the things I'm talking about in that book too, is like, I'm so grateful for the time and the space to really enjoy being by myself. And I think within the society that romanticizes romantic love and partnership mm-hmm. as like the pinnacle of a successful life, I really, really desire for more of everybody, but women in particular, to take that off as the pedestal and to really think of like, how can I romanticize and enjoy my life every single day? And, you know, I think about my female friendships and I think about my platonic friendships and like how much joy those bring me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this concept of like creating a life that feels really full and really beautiful, and that like romantic partnership, if you have it or you don't have it, you still have a life that feels really lovely and nourishing and energizing that you're really excited about. I don't know. I'm on TikTok a lot, and I don't know if TikTok like knows I'm single, but like I get like always sending me these like dating coach videos and all of this stuff. And I have like nothing against dating coaches. Oh. I have nothing against dating coaches at all. But I'm like, why is it that like all of it feels like women are supposed to be devoting all of their attention mm-hmm. to like seeking this Prince Charming. And then when they get that, everything is going to be better mm-hmm. versus like, there's so many other things to spend their energy on. Again, I know everybody has their own personal experience with romantic relationships and with dating. But I am in a place in my life that I feel so fulfilled by my life that if I met someone, it would have to add joy to my life. Right. And if it doesn't do that, I'm simply not interested. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Also joy, but maybe some extra additional money too.
Listen, I mean, I'm so glad you said this. I didn't know if I should go there, but let me just say, I'm so tired of also like the internet telling, especially Black women, that we should just settle for whatever. And like, who cares if they have resources and if they have money, like it's all about love. Like, I am not accepting any of those messages. Mm-hmm. Like, if you are not also adding some Benjamins to my life, like, no, thank you. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I can say that here.
Yeah. I'm sharing a space with you and I'm not paying like for it or for more than you are contributing. And yes, sure. Like, there are compromises and jobs and all of these things. And right, we're still in capitalism. Love is great, but I have bills.
Does not pay the bills.
I want to travel. All of these things. Yeah. I think that goes along with your joy. Like, if you are not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? And I think it's so true to be said, like, it's so important to be said, like, love does not pay the bills. And also, I'm paying my own bills right now. Right. So, like, if you're not all, right. like, if you can't at least come to the table with something similar mm-hmm. or, and like, what am I doing here? Right. Because I'm not asking someone to provide a lifestyle that I can't provide for myself. I'm asking you to come to the table as like a fairly equal partner so that we can continue doing these fabulous things together and travel and do all these things we want to do.
Right. Cause yeah, you do travel all about.
And I like it and I want to keep doing it.
It looks amazing. I totally enjoy those Instagram stories for you. Yeah. Can you say more about the messages to Black women when it comes to the dating? I've seen so many, like, specifically for Black women on the settling, like, you just need a man. You don't need a man to take care of you or pay your bills. Like, that's so old. Like, all you need is somebody who cares about you. And I get that. But also,
I think that it's really interesting because, you know, if we look at Black women historically, we've always, in a lot of ways, been seen as like struggling and like really, you know, holding our entire Black people down and like really being like, you know, the anchor of the Black community. Mm-hmm. And I think it's become very normalized. Like, this whole idea of like a strong Black woman, like, I reject that. No, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's become so normalized that when we even see Black women thriving, or we see Black women, quote unquote, living like a soft life, whatever that means, that like sometimes people have like this, like, they almost like judgment towards it, right? Because like, it must not be for Black women to live this way, or to have a husband or a provider that takes care of the bills, that they don't have to do that. And I'm not saying that we should be striving for that. Mm-hmm. But what I am saying is that, like, I reject this idea that my life is supposed to be struggle and that it's supposed to be hard and that I'm supposed to be like holding it down for everyone in my life. Mm-hmm. And that I should just be settling for a man just because I need one, like, or because, who was it recently that, oh, like Tyler Perry, right? Like, he was saying, like, who cares if, you know, he has money, as long as he can like contribute to the light bill or something. And he was like, he said this on like a podcast, and it was like all over social media. And I was like, this is the most ludicrous. You're telling me that I should bring a man into my house, into my space, pay all the bills, do everything for him, as long as he can love me and pay a light bill.
Right.
Like, that should be enough for Black women. Mm-hmm. And almost leading to the fact that, like, that's why so many Black women are single is because our standards are too high.
Right.
But we never hear this messaging around white women or Asian women or any other women. Mm-hmm. Are we telling them, just let a man come pay your light bill, that'll be good enough? And it's like, why should I accept that? Mm-hmm. And again, to what you were saying, I'm already paying all the bills. The light bill is not that much. You're like, you're not really taking
the,
much.
The smallest bill that I pay.
The smallest bill, right? What am I benefiting? Because you're just going to love me, and so you're going to come live in my house and I'm going to take care of you.
I could get a dog who would do the same thing.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the dog would be less trouble. Yeah. I'm just saying. So it's like, I want all of us collectively, Black women in particular, to get to this point where we feel so confident in who we are, and like also cultivate lives. Again, I keep going back to this place of like cultivating lives that don't feel void if we don't have a romantic partnership, so that like that thing that we don't find ourselves like allowing nonsense just because we're so desperate to have this thing that we are told we're supposed to have.
I love that. Yeah, that does not have to be the case. It's great.
No, it doesn't have to be the case. And again, I keep going back to the fact that, like, I want us also to reframe our mindset around what makes a life fulfilled, because all of the research shows us that the happiest women are single women without children, like, statistically speaking. They're actually the happiest people. So it's like, we can also just sit with the fact that we can be really, really happy even if we don't have kids or a partner, maybe even happier than if we had those things. So it's really this process of like decolonizing our minds from like what the patriarchy is continually, you know, shoved down our throats all these years to convince us that that's the thing that's going to be happiest, when the statistics show us that that's actually not the thing necessarily that is going to bring us happiness or joy.
100%. And talking about your life and how it's, you know, leveled up over the years, do you want to start with like the photo and you and your sister and all of those things?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's so interesting because when I started doing things online, I really was just like, you know, sharing about my life, really. And I remember my sister and I posted a picture of just like the two of us in normal bodies. And we were working out outside of the park. We had on sports bras and the picture kind of went viral. It's actually, in hindsight, it's like, it's funny because it was like, it was just two Black women in their bodies working out. You know what I'm saying? And I literally think the caption was like, this is what Black women working out looks like. It was something very simple. And it like went viral because people were like, wow, these are two Black women who don't have like super thin bodies. And they're showing the world that it is okay to work out in your sports bra. And I was like, cool, you know? Mm-hmm. But that really became a full circle moment that because like the summer I got to shoot a campaign with Nike and I got to bring my sister with me. Mm-hmm. And so that felt really cool because we were again, both in our sports bras working out and shooting this really cool campaign, which is like probably one of the coolest campaigns I've ever shot. Nice. And so to have her with me able to do that was also, it was really amazing. And it was so great to have her with me. And I think the thing that I've learned through everything that I've done, it's just like, just put out whatever work you want to put out into the world, right? There's really no rhyme or reason. And I think that people oftentimes, especially now, they get really caught up in with like the algorithm and it's not whatever. And yeah, the algorithm sucks. It's true. Mm-hmm. And also, I just think that we can't try to make work to quote unquote trick the algorithm. I think it's so important to just put out the things that feel authentic to you and whatever happens with them happens. Like I don't play the game if I'm trying to beat the algorithm, I'm trying to do all the trendy things. Mm-hmm. That doesn't even feel good anyways. It's like, just do the work that you want to be doing in the world and the right people will find you.
Yeah. I love that. And speaking of the work that you were doing in the world, I would love to talk more about your book from beginning to end. So tell me, you know, did you submit a proposal? Did you find an agent? Like, what were all the steps that went into the Body Liberation Project coming into our hands?
Yeah, I feel like this is the perfect segue because my story is pretty much just what I was just talking about. I was just like doing things. And so what happened with me is that like, I knew, you know, at some point, I was like, some point in the future, I want to write a book. I don't know how that's going to happen. I'm not really even stressing about it. Like, mm-hmm. someday it'll happen. Mm-hmm. And so prior to 2020, I was like freelancing for like Women's Health and Shape Magazine and other platforms like that. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an article for Shape Magazine during 2020 that was entitled, What's It Like to Be a Black Body Positive Fitness Trainer? Mm-hmm. The article wasn't even about me. I interviewed three other Black women in the space and wrote the article. And again, thinking of things like, why would this be the thing, right? Because it was a nice article. I think it was great, but I don't think it was anything revolutionary. And it went viral. The article went viral. And I got an email from the Today Show to come on and talk about the article. Mm-hmm. And it was during 2020. Virtual. Mm-hmm. And it was me and one of the women who was in the article with me. Mm-hmm. And so we had a segment that was really great. And then like 2 weeks after that aired, I got an email from this man at a publishing house. And he was like, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I was like super skeptical because I'm like, huh, what are you talking about? But I screenshotted it and I sent it to my best friend. And I'm like, you think this is a scam? And she's like, I don't know. I should email back. Like, that's the only way you'll know. And so I did an email back and I had a call with this individual and he basically just like asked me, he said, he saw me on the Today Show. He thinks that I have like something like really important to talk about. And, I had not really thought through exactly what the book would be about. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like kind of like spit firing ideas with him. We talked for like a half an hour and he ends the call by saying like, I really like what you're talking about. Can you send me a few paragraphs because I'm going to pitch it to team. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is like, I feel like this is a real thing. And so I remember I got that call and I thought of like a peer that I had met through social media. I met her one time in real life and I know that she had published traditionally and self-published. Mm-hmm. And so I literally sent her a DM and said, can I pay you for a call? Mm-hmm. Because I have questions about this thing that just happened. Mm-hmm. And I briefly explained what happened. Said, absolutely. So she sent me a link to pay her. I paid her. I got on the call with her. I explained it. She's like, this is really good. she talked to me a little bit about the publishing process. She was like, this is really great. She's like, but you definitely need a book agent. Mm-hmm. And my mind was like, okay, where do you get one from the phone book? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you just get a book agent, right? Mm-hmm. And also this person's name is Rebecca Baruki. She's the founder of Row House Publishing now, but she did not have a publishing company at the time. Nice. And so she's like, I know a really good agent. I don't know if she'll want to represent you, but I can at least introduce you. And I was like, great. So she sent an email. I end up having a call with my now agent, Wendy, the next day, Wendy Sherman. Like, we had a call for like, you know, 30 minutes. She's like, I would love to represent you. I was like, cool. Mm-hmm. I didn't do any research. I was just like, great. This sounds wonderful. Yeah. And she's a great agent. So it's good. But then the next day I got an offer back from the publisher and I introduced them and they offered me a book deal. And my agent, who I had met, you know, 48 hours ago, was like, this is a pretty good deal for a first-time author. She's like, but you also haven't written a book proposal. You haven't done any of the steps. She's like, I would never tell you to turn this down. But if I were you, I would go through the process of writing a book proposal. Mm. And then we can probably pitch to publishers. And I was like, all right, I trust you. So I turned the book deal down. I hired someone to help me with the book proposal, which is like a whole nother thing.
Yeah.
Jessica, you understand. Like, I had no clue how labor-intensive a proposal was. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, if I had known that, I probably would have just taken the other deal. Right. Because, like, I didn't
understand. Yes.
I didn't understand what I was getting myself into. No. But, anyways, I ended up writing the proposal and we then shopped the book around and I ended up getting five offers from different publishing houses. Mm-hmm. And it all worked out in the end because the book deal that I ended up getting with my publisher, which is Tiny Reparations, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. That publishing deal was actually five times what the other person offered me. So it was 100% worth it, but it was a journey. Yeah. It's a journey.
I love that. So proposal is in. Now you have to write the book.
Now you have to write. That's the exciting part. Was like, yeah, I got a book deal.
Yep. Yes. And then
you're like, oh shit, I have to write a book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the tougher part of this. That's the tougher part, right? The actual writing of the book.
So many words.
It's so many words. And what I will say, though, is having done the book proposal actually was helpful because it is like a blueprint of the book, right? So, like, I needed to do that, actually, because you do put so much work into the proposal that actually just like, feels like the roadmap to writing the book. Mm-hmm. But it's still so many words.
Exactly.
And I think that no one adequately prepared me. And I wonder how you feel about this. I feel like, and not that it was anybody's job, but like, I feel like nobody adequately prepared me for like how in the trenches it would feel sometimes writing a book.
1000%. While I was doing it, I was looking up books on the book process and how to write a book. I'm like, there's got to be a resource out there that's just like what to expect when you're expecting all of these things. I want that book. I want to read that book because this cannot be the way that I am supposed to feel. Turns out maybe I am, but still, like, I just want somebody to tell me what to expect, like, all along this way.
And there's just, it's so many emotions, right? Like, such a roller coaster. And I feel like I had good days, writing days where I'm like, oh my God, I'm great at this.
Yeah.
And everything's still good. The next day I'm like, I should have never taken this money from this.
What if I don't finish it? I have to pay it back. Like, what am I doing? Yeah.
Yes. There's so many emotions involved and it is just such a journey. And I think then you finish the first draft and you're like, okay, I did it, but that's really not, you know, more editing. That's really not it.
Nope.
It's really not it. And then when you finally finish the manuscript, like you have your finished book, you're like, yes. And then you're like, oh shit, now I have to sell this book. Mm. And there's just so many things that you have to go through that I have on the other side. I have so much respect for authors. Like, I have so much respect because I know what goes into it. Yeah. And I know like all the emotions and hard work. And in so many ways, I know people will be upset with me for saying this, but like in so many ways, it feels like you're birthing something into the world. Yeah. And then like, you're just waiting to see how people are going to receive this thing that you put so much effort and energy into.
Correct. I think that's perfect. And also, like, I want to know what to expect. Like, if somebody had just told me, like, those parts, I wouldn't have had, you know, whatever expectations I had. I just would have loved to know what to expect. So you had a black team. Tell the people about all of those parts.
Yeah. So Tiny Reparation is run by Phoebe Robinson, who's formerly, like, part of Two Dope Queens, and she's lovely and amazing and phenomenal. So I was really excited about the prospect of working with them. Like even before I was talking to all these different publishers after my meeting with them, I was like, that's the publisher I want to work with.
Nice.
So she's the head of the imprint. And the team has both white women and women of color on the team. My editor was a white woman, but she was lovely. What I appreciated the most about Tiny Reparations and working with them as a publisher is that at no step during the process did they try to like tone down my voice or like try to get me to not be careful about what I was saying.
Wow.
They gave me a complete creative freedom to write. And having talked to lots of other folks who, I don't know what it was, but like around the time I was writing books and like lots of people I knew were writing books. And I know now that that's not always the case.
Correct.
And I think that I would be really disappointed had I been with a publisher who tried to tone police me in any way. Yeah. That would have been really, really disappointing. Mm-hmm. And so I loved the creative freedom they gave me. And I just love the support that they gave me. I feel like the Rochelle Fredson is who I worked with for my book proposal process. Mm-hmm. She's a book coach, but she worked in publishing for 20 years as a person who acquired books. Like, so she knows the publishing industry in and out. And every time I was just telling her about my experiences, she's like, she's like, this is probably one of like the best experiences that I've heard someone having in terms of everything being smooth.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, I really appreciate that now. Mm-hmm. I got really lucky to have like a really supportive team and a really supportive publishing process.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's not always the case. And publishing is really white, right? I think it's like 2% of authors or 2% of the publishing industry is Black. Mm-hmm. I think both in terms of authors, but like also who's working in the publishing industry.
Yeah.
And so needless to say, there is lots of opportunity to have experiences that are not so positive. So I feel really fortunate in that regard.
I was so excited to talk to you and just hear how things could be good in the whole process. I was so happy for you. I'm so happy that it exists out there. I'm one of the lucky many or unlucky many who had a wild ride.
Unfortunately, I think that is like the experience.
Yeah.
And it feels like from more often than not, which is like really, really disappointing.
I feel like it's a lot of the stuff that we saw in 2020, we're trying, how you and I got book deals, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And then you got people who were continually committed to that work. And I love that so, so much.
Yeah, I think the book industry, I mean, everything you're speaking to, right? I think that 2020 happened and people were like, oh my God, we got to do better, right? Without any real understanding of what that actually looks like practically speaking, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because that requires a lot. So I think that all of a sudden publishers were just like, yeah, we have a diversity problem. Let's give everybody a book deal. Let's do all these things.
Uh-huh.
And granted, I think that all the people who got book deals were worthy of the book. Like we deserve to have the book deal.
Yes.
We should have always had the book deals, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I think is I don't think that folks were really equipped for the work that they claimed they were doing. They didn't really have the skills to do that work. Mm-hmm. I think what's so unfortunate about, whether we're talking about the publishing industry or just like Black folks in general, from like all of the promises that were made in 2020, is ultimately the folks that were most impacted and most harmed by all of the things that happened were us. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And like, yes, there were some positive moments, but like when I look back where we are now versus where we are in 2020, mm-hmm. I'm like, that was all for show. Mm-hmm. That was all for show. And I think a lot of us, probably knew that was going to be the case.
Yeah. Like there was some hope. I feel like I had hope. Like this time it's going to be different.
Nope, not so much.
No.
And I think what's really unfortunate about the publishing industry just overall is that there is this very, generally speaking, there's a very short attention span to the shelf life of a book, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, especially based on your publisher and like even an imprint, because I have another friend who published a book under the Penguin Random House publishing house, but like a different imprint than me. And that imprint was putting out like 20 books the same month his book is released.
Correct.
So it's like, how much individual attention can they devote to your book if they have 20 books coming out that month? And unfortunately, that's what happens a lot of time where they just don't have, because they're just mass producing and putting out books. They're not giving you individual attention to really help towards the success of your book, which also, if you're a first time author and you don't really know what to expect, like you need help. Because you really don't know what you're doing. You don't know how to do it.
No.
There's nobody coaching first time authors on like what to prepare for and how to prepare to sell your book.
Yes.
Yeah.
1,000%. So then March 7th, 8th, what day did your book come out?
Mine was March 14th.
March 14th. It's so out.
Almost been a year.
It's out. Yeah. You get one of the biggest, brightest things that I was so excited for you. Can you just tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, it still feels like surreal. So my book comes out and I get an email that morning, the same morning my book came out, which is so cool because my family was in town to support it and everything. And I got an email from my publisher that my book was on a billboard in Times Square. It was one of five books. And it is still like for me, like the probably like the cool, one of the most cool things that's ever happened to me, because I moved to New York end of 2019, right before the pandemic. I had no clue what the hell I was doing here. I just needed to start to try something different. So I came here. I didn't know what I was doing. I had the worst start to New York. I guess it's a fairly New York experience, but I had a terrible roommate. After 5 days, I had to move out. I had a severely sprained ankle because of living. It was just a terrible experience, right? Mm-hmm. And so then the pandemic hit, and so, like 5 months later, and I just like didn't know what was going on. And I don't think my family knew what I was doing either. They were real concerned about me. This one's lost. So to have like this moment, like almost exactly 4 years later, mm-hmm. and have my book on a billboard mm-hmm. was like so special and it was so cool. And have my family here to see it. And my nephew, who was 16 at the time, he was impressed. And when you impress a 16-year-old, you're like, oh, yeah.
Nice.
I have done the thing. So it was really, really, really cool experience to have. Yeah.
Awesome. And since then, what do you think about your book's reception and the whole selling process? Because that was another part that I wasn't prepared for. The amount of expectations on the author to sell their own book. I was like, wait, you told me you were going to sell my book. At least in my publisher conversations, they were like, yes, we're going to support you to sell your book. You know, just reach out to a few people, da, da, da. Was not prepared.
No, I don't think anybody, I honestly like talking to anybody now about people saying they want to write a book or whatever, or in the process of writing a book, I just keep, and I don't want to scare them.
No.
But like, I really want to stress to them how involved you are actually going to be in the book selling process. Mm-hmm. Like, it is no joke. And it requires an incredible amount of effort from the author. Like, your publisher will help you to a certain degree, but it is on you to sell that book. Mm-hmm. And it is not easy. Like, and I think it's also like, because you've been through this process of like 18 months, you're already feeling very drained.
Exactly. Exhausted.
And now you're like, and I have to sell the book now. Yeah. Right. So it's just really, I felt like after, so like 3 months after the book came out, I felt like I was tapped out and like I literally felt like for 3 months and the next 3 months, I was just like doing nothing because it is so exhausting. And I don't want to downplay that to anybody. Like, I encourage you, if you want to write a book, to do it, but I do not want to downplay to anybody like how much it requires of you as an author to sell the book, to push the book, to keep talking about the book. And I don't know if you experienced this, Jessica, but when you've been writing a book for like, you know, almost 2 years, you're tired of talking about the book now because you've been talking about this for 2 years. But the audience, this is all you can talk about is this book. Mm-hmm. No matter how many times, how many podcasts, how many interviews you've done, you're just gonna keep talking about the book. It is so exhausting. And I think also like, you know, at least me, right? Like, I very much follow writers and I see like New York Times, this and this, and this. And what we think that like books just like fly off the shelves.
Right.
That's actually also not true. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Also tempering expectations for and even I would encourage people to have a conversation with their publisher before that about like, expectations that your publisher has for book sales. Nice. What are the expectations? Yeah. What can you expect? Like, what should you expect? What should your goal be? Because I didn't ask any of those questions and I didn't have any of those answers. And I think I was just like in for a rude awakening at first, because I think I imagined that like, of course, everybody, I had, you know, over 70,000 Instagram followers. I'll sell 20,000 copies in the first 2 weeks. Yes, why not? Will.
Right.
It does not work like that.
No.
It doesn't work like that at all. And I think one other thing I will say that really helped me put things in perspective, though, because I was disappointed I feel good about book sales now, but I was initially disappointed like within the first week because I was just, I don't know what I was expecting. I didn't, mm-hmm. I was just, you know, expecting to fly. Why wouldn't everybody in the whole world buy this book?
Because it's a good book.
But I remember, I'm like, what? This is a good book. What do you mean? Yeah. But I remember feeling a little disappointed in the first month. And I went back and had this conversation with Rochelle, my book coach, which is why I say she was so wonderful to work with, because that, you know, Rochelle is like now my friend. And, you know, she's taken on so much more than just helping me with the proposal. But I remember telling her that I was a little disappointed. And she was like, I just want to put something in perspective for you. Mm. And she's like, again, this is something that most people don't know. She said only 10% of books that ever get published sell over 1,000 copies.
What?
And exactly. What? See what I'm saying? And so she's like, yeah. So she, and this time I was well over that number. So she's like, you're already exceeding. So I want you to put it in perspective just a little bit. And I was like, I didn't even know that.
Wow.
So she's, I just want you to take a step back, and maybe the number's not where you wanted it to be yet. Correct. It will get there, but like also you're doing so much better than you think you are. Ugh. And again, I think we get this idea that like everybody's books is selling a bajillion copies and everybody, you know, and that's just like not the case.
Fascinating. Yeah. I stopped. I was asking probably to that 3 month mark. You're so right. I'm like, I just had this great podcast interview. She, you know, whoever the host was saying such amazing things, how many, you know, books I must've sold like hundreds of books from that talk.
At least hundreds. I was phenomenal on the podcast.
Yes.
I heard myself.
I did a great job. I said amazing things. Yeah, you were on a fucking billboard, like light billboard in Times Square. I was on like primetime news on like People. They're just mm-hmm. all of the people watching, they're gonna go press, you know? Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. I was on the Tamron Hall show the day after.
I know. I was like,
such a phenomenal episode. And I'm not just saying that because it was me. I'm saying like, it was like a really great segment.
Yeah.
I'm like, surely every person mm-hmm. who watched the segment is going to buy this book.
Surely.
Because this is a great segment. Mm-hmm. Doesn't work like that. it does not work like that.
Yes. I was told multiple times by my agent, we don't know what sells books. And I was like,
yeah,
what?
Mm-hmm.
So you asked me to write this book. You, and for my case, it doesn't sound like yours, you will tell me when I'm not selling enough or pushing this book enough. But at the same time, you don't know what sells books? Like, this is not what I need for my first book experience. But what you told me there, that statistic makes me feel amazing.
Yes. So when Rochelle told me that, I was like, wow, that does put things in perspective, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting to, again, being on the other side is like, listen, TV appearances are cool. I'm always going to take it if they give it to me. But it also is really not a good mover necessarily of book sales. Like, yeah. It's cool to say you're on a show yeah. and I will always go on every time they invite me.
Yeah.
But again, it's really not, and it's not really a thing that moves the mark in terms of book sales. And like, to be honest, it is really unpredictable sometimes about what are the things that are going to sell the book. Could it just be people connecting with you on social media, some podcasts? Like, and I think podcasts actually are much better than even being on TV.
I agree.
But it's just like, we also like, I think the world hypes up certain things and like being on TV feels so prestigious mm-hmm. and it is prestigious and it's really cool, but it's not necessarily going to help you sell your book, you know?
Yeah. People are there to watch TV, not to read books.
And also let's just think about the demographic of like who's yeah, watching who's Good watching. Morning. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't watch Good Morning America unless one of my friends is on there. I'm not like regularly tuning into Good Morning America, right?
Yeah.
Those probably aren't the readers. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yes. Knowing what you know about publishing, you still want to write another book.
I do. I do. You know, it's so funny. Again, people will probably be upset by this, but when I was writing a book, I was like, I will never do this again. I was in the trenches. I was like, I will never do this again. Mm-hmm. And this is what I feel like people who have children will feel like.
Oh.
They're like, this is terrible. I will never do this again. And then as soon as you like have your kid, you're like, wow, this is so great. Maybe I will do this again. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. No, parents, don't get upset with me. I am not saying writing a book is the same as having a child, but I'm saying, I think that feeling, that sentiment, because I definitely was like, this was a mistake. I will never do this again. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, I can't wait to do that again.
Wow. I love that for you. Do you know what it's going to be?
She's like, I love that for you.
No, well, I think part of me, and I will have shared this already on an earlier episode, but part of me was just so resentful of my publishing experience. At some point, I was like, I want to write another book knowing everything that I know, knowing, better how to sell this book, doing, you know, all of the things that, you know, I was not told to do or not encouraged to do. I want to write another book so that it is mine, so that I like can put it out there in a way that it reaches the people that I want it to reach. So that, like, I don't know if spite is a good reason to write a book, but you know what? I'm motivated by being petty. So you know what?
Yeah. But also, I don't even know if that's petty, because I do think there's something to be said about doing something and having the true experience and understanding now.
Yeah.
So that you feel like you have more control over how the process feels for you, because you like actually know what to expect. So I don't know. I don't think that's petty. I think that, and I mean, and to be honest with you, that's like also, even though I had like, I would consider a very good experience, there's still so many things that I learned, you know, that I just didn't know the first time around that I feel like I'll be so much better equipped going into it again.
If I were to do one again, it would be more science and more like ultra processed food nonsense-y stuff. And,
I like that.
Yeah. And more like of the critiquing everything out there about public health and food and Dr. Robert Lustig's like just starve message that he gave. You know, just starve. But what will your next book be about?
Yeah. So I think my next book is about still in the theme of liberation, but like liberation beyond the body. So talking, I mean, although I feel like I shared a lot of like personal stuff in the first book, the second book is way, way more personal. Also like scary a little bit too, to like put so much of yourself out there in the world. But I want to talk about like what living a truly liberated life looks and feels like, or can look and feel like for folks. So for me personally, I'm going to be talking about like divorce. I'm going to be talking about grief. I'm going to be talking about, you know, a lot of like personal family stuff, talking about my decision to be child free, really encouraging folks to like let go of this idea of like where we're supposed to be at a certain time in life. Because as I'm approaching 40, I feel like I'm literally just getting started. And it pains me to hear folks like in their 20s or 30s feeling like they need to have it all figured out, because I'm like, literally, you don't. And so also just giving ourselves also the permission to change courses and change directions as many times as we want to or need to throughout the course of our lives. And like also like the freedom to part ways with things that just don't serve us anymore, whether that's relationships, whether that's jobs, whether that's like cities, like whatever the things are. And so like, how do we do that in the pursuit of living a life that feels fully liberated? And I think it's always through the lens of like my experience as a Black woman and what that means to live as a liberated Black woman within a society that doesn't necessarily like to see free Black women.
I am so excited to read this book. I am so excited, especially, yes, with the You Can Pivot. I just did a pivot episode and like I was having anxiety about the idea of pivoting and not having like a long-term plan for like what this next life is going to be like. But I'm already ready. I'm ready to sell your book for you.
I'm ready to sell it this time too. I know I'm better prepared to sell it this time around. But I'm really excited. I was excited about the first book too. But I feel really, really excited about writing this book. So yeah.
That makes me so happy. I loved this conversation. I could do this so many times, and I'm going to have you back. We already mentioned in the pre-show that writing or having a conversation about the decision to be child-free is one.
That's like a whole episode.
Yes, that we should be having. So I would love to have you back for that.
I would love to come back for that. It'd be my pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much, Chrissy.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks again to Chrissy King, author of The Body Liberation Project, How Understanding Racism and Diet Culture Helps Cultivate Joy and Build Collective Freedom. I hope to bring her back and get into more of the topics we brought up here today. Hearing her talk about her next book really got me thinking. The day after we recorded this interview, I started thinking about recreating the full ultra-processed food experiment that Dr. Chris Van Tulleken did, this time with all the biometric tests. See, Tulleken only did two sets of tests, once after he did the month of zero processed food and then after a month of eating 80% ultra processed foods. We don't know what his labs or weight were at baseline. And if what we saw after the second month of UPFs was just a return to his baseline, if I were to do the experiment, I'd want to know all of that. I hope folks would want to know that too. I'm thinking about writing that book, including the info and critiques Amy provided, how baby formula is an ultra-processed food, and the double standards applied to vegan cheese and impossible meat versus a McDonald's burger patty, bun, ketchup, and dairy cheese. That would require a book proposal. And then, a few days ago, while texting with friend of the podcast, Isaac, I had an idea to write a third book, this time fiction and a bit of horror. Geneva deserves an ending to her story, and I want to give her one. I'd also like to rescue Cheerio. I've brainstormed the initial storyline. The working title is What Happened to Geneva? Until next time, friends, make things awkward. This has been Making It Awkward. I'm Jessica Wilson. The person behind the editing and music behind Geneva and Cheerio's letter is Jen Jacobs, who also edits and mixes this show. A video of me reacting to Allison's reenactment can be found on the Patreon. This is a production of The Body Politic and is supported by Patreon members. It's also supported by my book, It's Always Been Ours, and the legacy of Sacramento Outboard Services.